From the BBC in London, this is Meridian.
And from me, Sarah Dunant.
And me, Jim Hiley.
Welcome to Meridian's Look Back at 1982.
A highly selective, idiosyncratic even, reminder of the year's high spots in the arts.
The places we went.
And the people we met.
Some of the events that caused controversy.
And one or two less sensational happenings that were just plain interesting.
We'll be hearing again of the things that Meridian loved.
And the things we hated.
From the world of books, films,
art, music and the theatre.
And in the theatre, it wasn't just shows that opened this year. In March, Humphrey Carpenter put on his dinner suit and took Meridian to a very impressive occasion.
A fanfare for a royal occasion, played by the state trumpeters of the Blues and Royals. We're here in the heart of the City of London, the capital's business and financial district, not a very long stone's throw from St Paul's Cathedral. I'm a few yards from a lake with fountains. High above me is an art gallery. Behind me are an elaborately furnished theatre and concert hall, and deep beneath me, many floors down, is a cinema. And if none of that quite makes sense, don't be surprised, because what I'm describing is entirely new. Meridian has come here to attend the official opening on Wednesday night this week by Her Majesty the Queen of the City of London's new Barbican Centre.
The opening of the Barbican, now the permanent home of the London Symphony Orchestra and the London base for the Royal Shakespeare Company. Well, 9 months on, the Barbican has proved an artistic success, although in more practical vein, audiences are still regularly getting lost, moving from the car park to the auditoriums, me included.
Yes, I think just about everybody finds it easier to find their way around the Royal Shakespeare's other home at Stratford-upon-Avon. And there, of course, the company had one of its best seasons for years. Shakespeare's King Lear and Edward Bond's modern anti-heroic version of the same story were given on consecutive nights. And I also enjoyed the first night of The Tempest with Mark Rylance, who acted and sang beautifully the part of Ariel.
Where the bee sucks, there suck I. In a cowslip's bell I lie. There I couch when owls do cry, when owls do cry. On the bat's back I do fly after summer merrily. Merrily, merrily will I live now, will I live now. Under the blossom that hangs on the bough, that hangs on the bough.
Of course, we should emphasise that not every Meridian is spent watching first night curtains go up on magical productions. Being a regular Meridian presenter also means a fair amount of time spent with your head in a book. Although one of the bonuses of this programme is that you often get to meet the people who write the books. And sometimes you can even persuade them to read to you. Roy Heath, for instance, the Guyanese writer, brought his own special touch to the opening of his picaresque novel, Kweku.
This is a tale of Kweku, who was reduced to a state of idiocy by intelligent men, but made a spontaneous recovery. A quick look round at his fellow men convinced him that there was much protection in idiocy, and that intelligence was like the plimpler palm, bearer of good fruit, but afflicted with thorns. So he fell back into a state of idiocy, only to recover again for love of punishment and a hankering after passion. All this took place before Kweku was 10 years old.
Roy Heath. And still on the subject of childhood, I wonder how many of you can recognise this voice. England's most highly rated literary spycatcher, who was the subject of a Meridian special earlier in the year when one of his best-known books was made into a television series. In the programme, Frank Delaney asked him the revealing question, was he a well-behaved child?
Scrupulously well-behaved, appallingly polite, a little butler, not capable of doing anything naughty ever, which I now know to be a dangerous condition in a child, and very inward in consequence, a liar, a spy. Not a liar in as many words, but a liar about his feelings, and a spy in the sense that I think I observed very closely what was going on around me, kept my counsel, and now you might say, later in life, I'm writing my reports.
John le Carré, who obviously developed his espionage tendencies early in life. Although, Jim, I don't know about you, but for me, that TV version of Smiley's People was one of the disappointments of this year. The story was so tightly woven as to be nigh incomprehensible, and so stately as to occasionally grind to a complete halt, I think.
Well, I disagree slightly. I thought it was a feast of the kind of acting of understatement that Alec Guinness, who played Smiley, does so well. And what puzzles me is how people say that the Carré's books are difficult to follow, because I think they're very simple. They're very conventional spy stories, which are overlaid with a lot of fancy writing. Come back, Len Dayton, all is forgiven, that's what I say. Anyway, there were other special editions of Meridian this year devoted to such literary veterans as Robert Graves and Rebecca West. And talking of veterans, one of the best evenings I had was at the Royal Festival Hall here in London. The performers were from New Orleans, the Preservation Hall Jazz Band, and some of their members are as old as New Orleans music itself. Most of the time they sit playing impassively like mountainous Buddhas, but they really do have a mobilising effect on their audiences. A lot of the people at the festival hall were dancing in the aisles, and one couple even jumped onto the stage. They were jitterbugging like, and I hope, Sarah, I've got the correct expression, like it was going out of style.
Preservation Hall Jazz Band. And while we're on the subject of eccentric audiences, I must add the highlight of my year, which came on a special Meridian trip to Korea, where among the many unusual things I witnessed was a performance of pansori, a kind of cross between storytelling, opera and theatre. The afternoon I went, the audience was filled with exuberant octogenarians who sang along with all their favourite bits. And in one instance, a spectator even used the bald head of the man in front to mark time with the drum beats using a rolled-up newspaper as his stick. It's the nearest I've ever come to attending an old-age rock concert.
그러면 그게 해당하냐 명사십니까 그게 저도 해당하 그게 예술일까 그러면 그것이 귀신이란 말이냐 저 장면 밝은 날에 무슨 귀신이 예술일까 그러면 그게 무엇이란 말이냐 잔말 말고 건너갔다 오너라 방 자질 없이 주장부
Yes, Sarah, well, I can't help noticing that some of my fellow presenters really got around during 1982. Michael Billington presented an edition from the Adelaide Arts Festival, and Natalie Ween went to Mexico for the Guanajuato International Cervantes Festival, and I don't think that Korea was your only port of call, was it?
No, you're absolutely right. We stopped in Hong Kong for the first 10 days to attend an international arts festival there, from where we beamed back a live special programme to London.
Well, I only raise all this to go on to make the point that you don't have to leave Britain to hear Eastern music. For example, the third festival of Oriental music happened at Durham University in July, and there was work there from Laos, India, Turkey, Egypt, China, Indonesia, and, Sarah, from Korea. Reporting on this festival, Natalie Ween talked with the BBC music producer William Robson, and she put it to him that a lot of Westerners who describe themselves as serious musicians, not to mention the record companies, ignore the music of the East.
Yes, I believe the myth goes something to the order of that we only use 5% of the world's music in Western Europe and in America. But the trouble with this is, you know, there is also another myth connected to it, and that is the universality of music. This is absolute gibberish. It is not universal. It is nearly always specific to one race, or even in some parts of the world, to one town and one small part of the populace. Music is an art form used by every civilization, as far as I know, but it is used for the purpose of expressing what they wish it to express. And I think until you do a little bit of background work on what it is and what the population is trying to achieve by this art music, it won't mean much to you.
I think that's when I most enjoy presenting Meridian, when you don't get the answer you might have expected from people being interviewed. And it's nice to know the arts can still be a bit controversial. Something similar happened to Natalie again when she talked to the Swiss oboe virtuoso Heinz Holliger, who was in London for some recitals at the Festival Hall. She asked him what might seem a perfectly reasonable question. Had his way of playing been influenced by the French oboe style?
I don't hope that my oboe has a passport. I hope to play in my own way, and I don't think it's at all a French way. I don't understand why instruments should have a nationality, I think. It just has to project the personality of the player who plays. It's the only meaning of an instrument. And I'm not at all interested in any schools. This is a sort of musical racism which goes along, and I very deeply hate this.
Hans Holliger playing Schumann. 1982 was also a year when the arts often walked hand in hand with politics and current affairs, and there was no better example of that than the Falklands War. While TV cameras were struggling to send back their instant news fodder, there was also another kind of reporter on that battlefield. Linda Kitson, the first ever official woman war artist, was braving the most appalling conditions to make her own artistic record of the conflict.
Any war zone has danger around it just in terms of tripwires, bits and pieces which are lethal. You are always in something that has been totally haphazardly mined. You were never really safe. But that would not have jeopardised the quality of the drawing, except for the difficulties that it physically put you in terms of where it all took place. Some of the most crucial drawings were done in the most horrendous for a draftsman circumstances, like at the top of mountains in that Arctic weather, or on airfields, or beaches. And if you think of the winds and the hail and the wet and the cold, you may be there, but you're minded about the drawing, because that's what you're doing there to bring back.
Of course, Linda Kitson wasn't the only artist to risk life and limb. Michael Pappas directed a film about the Turkish invasion of Cyprus in 1974 called Tomorrow's Warrior, and it was based partly on the true story of a Greek Cypriot boy who escaped from a refugee camp and tried to get back to his own village. Humphrey Carpenter asked Pappas about some of the more hair-raising moments of shooting on location.
In the final sequence, in which the boy crosses the barbed wire across a kind of no-man's land and goes towards occupied territory, he's going through a minefield, and this is how the film ends. And you actually shot that in that place, didn't you?
Yes, in fact, we took considerable risk shooting that sequence. It was the only way we could actually combine in one shot having the boy running towards the Carinia Range, the Blue Mountains, running back to his home. And I didn't want to do it optically because it would have been false. So we simply walked the minefield first, ensured that we could go in a straight line. And then, don't forget that behind us we had the Greek lines, and in front of us, and we could see them, were the Turks pointing guns at us. At a distance, but they were there. So the only way we could trick them was by putting the camera in a picnic basket. The cameraman, John McCallum, myself, and a little boy went into the minefield, sat somewhere in the middle of it, pretended we were having something to eat, set up the camera. I had the boy run. I shot it. Then we got up, put the camera in the basket again and wandered innocently towards the Turks and further into the minefield, sat down again and took the second shot. By that time, the Greek soldiers behind us were in panic and they started wiring and calling out and shouting because they thought we were going to be blown up or because we thought we were going to create an incident, because by that time the Turks realized that something was going on, but it was too late for them to do anything else because we were out and we had the shot in the can.
Film director Michael Pappas. As well as movies and art, politics even crept its way into the concert hall this year when the composer Peter Maxwell Davis premiered his work Black Pentecost, a passionate musical protest against the mining of uranium in the Orkney Islands where he lives. And to push his point home further, he made Black Star, a development corporation, the arch baddie of the piece.
Black Star is necessary for the welfare of the Western world, the fate of nations. If you refuse, the matter is out of my hands.
Some of the things based on current events were too, too flamboyant for comfort, a prime specimen being the film Who Dares Wins. This was inspired by the siege of the Iranian embassy in London 2 or 3 years ago and the exploits of Britain's famous or notorious Special Air Squadron. The producer of Who Dares Wins, Ewan Lloyd, joined Valdemar Januszczyk for a little studio knockabout with the author of a book on terrorism, Gerald McKnight.
I think there's a lot of phonus balonus about that, because the way in which the terrorists are shown in the film, they are supposed to be operating in a very open way with a beautiful girl leading them who seems to be very easily seduced by a defector from, or assumed defector from the SAS. And in my opinion, this is totally implausible. Now, having been around 16 countries and mixed with terrorists to the point where I became utterly depressed by the darkness and misery of their and wretchedness of their lives, I know that this is, it's not at all factual.
Ewan Lloyd, you must answer that.
I must disagree with an old friend. I refer quickly to Patty Hearst. Patty Hearst involved herself in sexual practices with her captors. She became a terrorist. How many people she came close to killing, we'll never know. But my main purpose was to make an entertainment film. And that is my sole purpose in life, because my films, or British films as they are, have to be shown in 40 countries or more.
Well, let me come in there, Ewan. I would have liked your film as a piece of entertainment and commended your way of making a good film for mass entertainment, had it not been for the fact that it purports to be something of a documentary, both on the programme note, which says that for the first time you are seeing the inside secrets of the legendary SAS, to the end frame, which tells us soberly that this sort of thing has happened in many embassies. I believe that that is propaganda, and I don't like the way it's done.
Well, Gerald, again, I have to disagree with you.
Who Dares Wins, proving that it's often the worst films that provoke the best arguments. Mind you, Meridian was probably the only programme in Britain to find someone who didn't like E.T., Steven Spielberg's blockbuster fantasy of a childhood love affair between an 11-year-old boy and an extraterrestrial being. Sheer fantasy, brilliant manipulation, and I'm not ashamed to say I wept uncontrollably through most of it.
Yes, I'm not ashamed to say that I wept through a lot of it as well. And people criticise Hollywood for this turn that it's taken into science fiction fantasy and, as it were, back to childhood. But I think films like E.T. and Star Wars are infinitely preferable to other films based on violent men screaming at each other and kicking the life out of each other.
We await E.T. 2. Of course, the year also came up with the unexpected in other fields of the arts. Sheridan Morley, for instance, had no idea what was going on when he ran into this.
Is Not perhaps the noise that you'd immediately expect to hear coming from the usually hushed hallways of the Tate Gallery in London. But there now is the first major British exhibition of the work of Jean Tingley, the Swiss artist who specialises in compilations of machinery, most of which, when started, are capable of extraordinary cranking sounds and bizarre movements. His major works include sculptures that can squirt water, throw balls, crush plates, or even destroy themselves while you watch.
Still among the visual artists, Michael Billington visited the Grand Old Man of English Sculpture, Henry Moore. This was on the occasion of the opening of the Henry Moore Centre for the Study of Sculpture in Leeds. And Moore, now 84 years old, had some advice for the aspiring sculptors who'd be working at the centre named after him.
People think that art is something that you can do just by instinct, like being a high jumper or so on. It wants a head, it wants a brain. Mm-hmm. And all the great artists, a marvellous all-round intelligence. If people think it's just something that you're, by fortune, good at, and it doesn't need struggle or brain or head, or that's stupid. It's not a... We're like trying to think that a writer needn't understand words, that he's just gifted as a writer. He has to use his head and his brain and his... And you have to do it in sculpture, in architecture, in painting, in poetry. All those people have to be above the average in appreciation of what the world has done already.
1982 had its fair share, some might say more than its fair share, of festivals. In the spring, there was Women Live, which aimed to bring the work of women performers to the centre of the stage. Robin Archer, a singer, songwriter, actress and feminist from Australia, talked to me about her one-woman show, A Star Is Torn, which is still running here in London. Robin Archer played 11 famous women performers, all of whom died young, from Marie Lloyd to Edith Piaf to Janis Joplin and, almost inevitably, Marilyn Monroe.
Marilyn Monroe is just as important to us as a singer, not just as an actress, because we believe that one of the reasons people don't think she was a singer is because nobody ever gave her a chance to be a singer.
Because she was made to be a sex symbol.
Absolutely that. But Monroe, for instance, we just do one song and say everything we want there because the main reason is I can look a little bit, with a little imagination, I can look a little bit like Judy Garland, but with all the imagination in the world, I can never look anything like Marilyn Monroe.
But the biggest festival here in London, and it almost seemed to last as long as 1982, was the Festival of India. Among a string of art exhibitions was one called In the Image of Man, and Prabhu Guptara talked about this with a somewhat bewildered Valdemar Januszczyk.
This is surely the most confusing section of the exhibition for us Westerners, because we have this pantheon of Hindu gods, and I really do defy anybody who isn't an Indian to understand them all.
Well, I think there are lots of Indians who don't understand the pantheon of Indian gods, because at one time there were more gods in India than there were people. I mean, the population of India when the British left was something like 300 million, and the population of Indian gods, according to our scriptures, 360 million.
But it wasn't just Indian gods and mythology that had an artistic airing this year. There was also a theatrical exploration of English legend in a spectacular one-man show that I saw way back in May. Abounding with monsters and heroes, Beowulf was the first ever recorded poem in the English language. And as actor Julian Glover proved 1,200 years on, its language was as rich and strange as its story.
Come on, one rainy night. The Skreedan Shedugenga. Gliding through the shadows came the walker in the night. The warriors slept, all except one, and this man kept an unblinking watch. He waited, pent heart swelling with anger against his foe. From off the moorland's misting fells came Grendel, stalking. Thakurm of Moora under Misliotham Grendel Gongan.
Julian Glover, whose one-man show was so successful when it opened in Bristol that it later went both to London and to the Edinburgh Festival. And so, of course, did Meridian. We did two shows from the north of the border, as well as special programmes from the Capital Jazz Festival at Nebworth, the the Dublin Theatre Festival and the modern dance extravaganza known as the Dance Umbrella.
Yes, and I'd like to chip in here to say that a lot of the Dance Umbrella events took place at the Riverside Studios, Hammersmith in West London. In fact, a lot of the events covered in Meridian generally took place there because Riverside Studios specialises in putting on the best of work from abroad. And I think it's a crying shame that as we speak, the studios look likely to close through lack of funding from the local authority.
I would certainly add my voice to that protest. Some of the best visits to the theatre this year came from me at Riverside, and one particular memory I have of a wonderful, enchanting musical evening, which I spent in the company of Nuova Compagnia di Canto Popolare, who specialise in preserving and recreating the traditional songs and dances of Italy.
Seem to be more awards in the arts every year. If you want to plug your product or boost your town's economy, the answer seems to be to announce a literary prize or to set up a film festival. Meridian went to as many award ceremonies as it could manage, including one of the longest established of them all.
Palme d'or à l'unanimité, ex aequo à Missing the Costa Gavras.
The American film Missing, winning the Palme d'Or at the Cannes Film Festival.
Later in the year came the Literary Awards, a whole clutch of them. The biggest and most prestigious here in Britain being the Booker Prize for the year's best novel. It was won by the Australian writer Thomas Keneally for Schindler's Ark. Because it was based on fact, though, some people claimed that this was not a novel at all and therefore not eligible for the prize. The judges obviously didn't agree with that, and when I met Thomas Keneally the day of the prize-giving, I wondered what he thought.
Well, that's a difficult question, and it's compounded by the fact that the American publisher, Simon & Schuster, are calling it officially a non-fiction novel, and they're making reference to that terrible American word, faction. But faction, though it's a barbarous word, is a good shorthand for the sort of book this book is.
Another novelist Meridian talked to was John Fowles. He seemed to like to stir things up a bit, not least his readers.
I like waking readers up, yes, because I think one special thing about the novel is the need for two people, really, to create the reading of the text. You know, the reader actually does a lot of work when he reads. And I'm perhaps being a little mischievous, in as much as through all my novels, really, I've sort of given the reader a prod every so often, and really said, it's time you did some work. You choose, or you think, or you be mystified, and all the rest of it. I don't like the vision of the reader as customer, that you must please him, you know, and you must rub your hands and bow to him the whole time. I like to think of him as an equal, who's got a job to do as well.
Well, I hope I don't sound pretentious if I say that Meridian would like to think that it had a similarly two-way relationship with its listeners.
But for now, maybe we should leave you with what was certainly one of my personal high spots of the year. Jim, I don't know if you agree, but I think the best evening I spent this year was at the National Theatre, a 30-year-old musical specially revived with all the pizzazz of Broadway. Guys and Dolls surely prove that the British can do what the Americans do for the musical.
Well, I'm delighted to agree with you and to let the cast of Guys and Dolls say goodbye for us.